Okay, so let's start. So it's been a week. And I didn't quite finish, as I'd expected, everything I wanted to say about naive Bayes and text classification. So let's finish that. Cast your mind back. We were talking about doing document classification. Think of it as email spam filtering into spam and non-spam. And we want to estimate the posterior probability of the class, spam or non-spam, given the document. And a document is basically a sequence of words. And we'd like to know, well, how do we represent D and hence estimate this likelihood of the document given the class. So we're thinking the world of generative models here, where we have this abstract model for generating a document from a class. And we looked at two abstract models, both of which essentially throw away sequence information. There's the Bernoulli document model, which throws away count information as well. You just got the entire vocabulary, toss a weighted coin. If it's heads, that word is in the document. If it's tails, the word isn't in the document. We also have the multinomial model, where a document is basically represented by an integer feature vector, where the elements give you the count or the frequency of each word in the document. And you can sort of think of the generative model for this one as, if you think of it rather than going through every word in the dictionary, but going through every word in the document, then you're just kind of rolling a vocabulary-sized dice for each word, and you just take what word comes up. And then, you know, words may occur more than once, and you'll get those in the counts. So that's all very well. And for the multinomial model, we had this way of estimating to estimate the document probability, we want to estimate the probability of each word given the document class. And basically, if you want to get past this slightly forbidding-looking notation, all it is a relative frequency where we're looking at the relative frequency of a particular word in the class relative to the total number of words in the documents of that class. So the relative frequency for a word like the might be something like 0.06, and for a word like zebra, it might be a lot smaller. Now then, words like zebra can be a problem. So we're estimating relative frequency, and we're getting the relative frequencies from our training data. So you might have quite a lot of training data, but you still might find that you don't have any documents where the word zebra occurs. In that case, your estimate, your p hat for zebra given the class, is going to be zero, because the relative frequency is zero, so the numerator of that thing is going to be zero, and the denominator is just the total number of occurrences of zebra. And, you know, it could be even worse than that. It could be zero over zero, which is not a number. This is a problem. This is a problem, because if you remember how we combine these word probabilities to get to a document probability, you can do it formally in the multinomial model, taking the product across all the words in the dictionary, or you can do it equally exactly by going each place in the document, looking at the probability of the first word given the class, the second word given the class, and we go and take a product of those probabilities. This is our naive Bayes estimate to go and get the overall document probability. So what that means, as the way it stands now, is that if you used this to do document classification, and the word zebra never occurred in your training documents, it never occurred in any of the spam emails. The word zebra never occurred in any of the spam emails. And then you get a spam email which is simultaneously telling you that you've won the lottery and selling you Viagra and whatever else spam emails do, and it's addressed to Dear Mr. Zebra. then that's a problem, because that dear Mr., they may have quite high probabilities. Then you get zebra, probability of zero, and that's going to zero out the whole product. That's bad news, because you're giving a probability of zero to that email being spam, and you probably don't think that really. So that's a deficiency in the way we estimate the model. Basically, it's what it says in bold. If a word, just because a word doesn't occur in the training data, doesn't mean it's not going to occur in the test data or in some future document of that class. If you give it a zero probability, then it means that you're always assigning a probability of zero to that. And basically, you probably never want to assign probabilities of zeros to things. Any given word, it's reasonable to assume, could occur in spam emails or non-spam emails. So it's the estimation that's at fault here. It's the way we estimate this probability of a word given the class. And the reason it's at fault is that just because a word doesn't occur in the training data, the reason it's a fault is that if a word doesn't occur in the training data, then this probability estimate is set to zero. So you can say that if you want to think of it more broadly, this thing is a maximum likelihood estimate. Relative frequencies are the way that you maximize the likelihood given the training data. But if you make these maximum likelihood estimates, then they will underestimate words that do not appear in the training data. And the underestimate may, in some senses, look not too disastrous. Instead of it being, instead of the true probability, whatever that is, might be, 10 to the minus 7 or something like that, and you estimate it as zero. That doesn't seem such a huge difference, but if you're taking products, it is a huge difference. So we would like to have an estimation that gives us something greater than zero for all these word probabilities, for all words and for all classes. Now, this actually turns out to be a general problem that's addressed. You may or may not be, you probably know that the sort of models that we use for machine translation aren't a great deal more complicated than this. They're a bit more complicated, but they're not a great deal more complicated than this. They tend to revolve around estimating probabilities for sequences of words rather than single words. But the same problem arises. You don't want to give a particular sequence of words a zero probability simply because it doesn't occur in what for machine translation is usually a massive amount of training data, because then it might mean a particular translation can never happen, and that's bad. So one way around this, and there's many ways around this. They're referred to as smoothing, and if I remember correctly, I think I left the tutorial question on about this. Yeah, question two addresses some issues relating to smoothing, and it's actually quite a big deal for these sort of estimates. Thank you for lending me your thing, by the way. I was very rude; I didn't ask, but you were kind of looking, so I thought I could do it. Smoothing's an important thing to do. So what smoothing basically means, is probabilities have to sum up to one. So if you're underestimating some probabilities, that's got to mean you're overestimating some other probabilities. So basically what you want to do is you want to move some probability mass from those words that you do observe in the training data, so have non-zero probabilities under maximum likelihood, to those words you don't observe in the training data, which have zero probability estimates under maximum likelihood. One way of doing this is a thing called Laplace's law of succession. Laplace was active in the late 18th and early 19th century, so it gives you an idea of how old this approach is. Laplace, incidentally, is really was a great, great mathematician, and a lot of the basics of probability, I think, and statistics are really due to Laplace. Be that as it may, what Laplace said is, well, one way you could deal with this is to add one to the count of every word type. So basically, if you don't see something, you assume it's got a count of one, you give it a dummy count of one. If you see something 100 times, you give it a count of 101. So that's a very simple change. You just go and have this add one in the numerator. Therefore, everything's always going to be greater than zero. And to take account of this, because you're adding one for every word, you better make sure you get your normalization right. So basically add the size of the vocabulary to the denominator, because if you add one for V words, then you better add V to the denominator, because that's V things you've added. And this gives you a modified, slightly more robust estimate for the probability of each word type. And for something like spam filtering, add one smoothing is often used in practice. There are many other ways to smooth. And the thing about add one smoothing is that it works well when basically you have many more examples than you have word types, or you have types that you're estimating. So, you know, you might only have a vocabulary of 50,000 words, and you may have like millions and millions and millions of examples. So you're only adding a very small percentage of things on as a smoothing thing. There can be cases where, if you're dealing with sequences of words, adding one to every possible sequence could be a really bad thing, because in this case, say you're dealing with sequences of three words, they're called trigrams. If you're dealing with sequences of three words and you add one to the count of every sequence you observe, say there's 50,000 different word types, different unique words, then that means there's 50,000 squared word pairs and there's 50,000 cubed word triples. So that would mean you're not just adding V ones, you're adding V cubed ones. And V cubed, 50,000 cubed, what's that? That's, 50,000 is, 5 times 10 to the 4. And so that would be 125 times 10 to the 12, or, you know, 10 to the 14. That's an awful lot of fake counts you're adding. You might well have less than 100 million words in your corpus. So that means when you've made your probability estimates, the huge, huge majority of the counts you have are in fact fake counts. So when you have a really large number of things, the add one smoothing doesn't really work so well, and you have to have alternative methods of doing that. It sounds crap, but I'm not going to tell you what those alternative methods are. However, if you're interested, you should take something like the machine translation course in a year or two's time. So let me just finish basically sort of summarizing these two different document models, the Bernoulli model and the multinomial model. So we talked about the different generative model. Basically, the Bernoulli model, you're drawing an entire document using this Bernoulli distribution, tossing a coin for each word in a vocabulary. Whereas for the multinomial model, you're drawing your words from a multinomial distribution, rolling a dice. And we have count, integers, integer elements in the multinomial vectors, and just binary ones in the Bernoulli vectors. And multinomial vectors takes into account multiple occurrences. Really, the multinomial one works quite well for whether documents are longer or shorter. The Bernoulli approach starts to work worse and worse as documents get longer, because you basically start to fill up the vector with ones, and it's hard to discriminate between different documents. Don't worry too much about the feature vector dimension. The important difference, if you want something that helps you remember the difference between the two models, think of the behavior of the word the. In a multinomial model, the probability of the given a document is about 5%, because that's sort of the kind of, you know, how many words when you're speaking English are the, about 5% of words. In the Bernoulli model, the probability of the given your class is about one, because that's saying, well, every document you get has the word the in. For emails and stuff, it'll be less than one because people frequently write short emails. Basically, it's really close to one, the probability of the given the document, because it's this kind of binary thing, and you're just looking at the probability of does the occur in the document or not. That's the interpretation of that probability. Whereas in this case, basically, this is the probability is the going to be the next word. It's a kind of word-by-word probability, whereas this is a whole probability. Finally, and this is kind of also helps you understand the difference between the two models. If you remember how the multinomial model works, the way you estimate the document probability is you're basically taking the product of probabilities of the words that actually occur in the document, and if a word occurs multiple times in the document, then that's what happens. Words that don't occur don't affect the likelihood, and this is because if you're taking the product along the document, they just don't come into the product. Or if you want to do it the other way and you're taking product along the dictionary, where you're taking to the power of the frequency, then you're basically taking things to the power zero, which is just a one in the product. Whereas for the Bernoulli approach, the non-occurring words do affect the likelihood, because you either use the probability p if a word occurs in the document, or 1 minus p if it doesn't occur in the document. So that's what I wanted to say, finish off about these naive Bayes text classifiers. Any questions? Okay. We shall now move from the discrete to the continuous. Incidentally, I have a public service announcement. It may well occur. Well, I don't know if you were in here last time. I have a card which looks like it's for a Unite residence, which will get into somebody's flat. If you've dropped it, it's here. If you think you might want to start a career as a housebreaker, it won't help very much because there's no unique identifier on the card, so you'd have to have a magnetic strip reader and I don't know. But if it's yours, it's here. Okay, we are now going to go into the world of continuous random variables. So some problems, and we've just been looking at one, are naturally discrete. If you're dealing with words, these are kind of discrete items, and you might, or perhaps the most straightforward way to deal with them statistically are approaches sort of based on counts, based on discrete probability distributions. Are you watching a movie? Because you all keep on clustering around that laptop and grinning broadly.
There's a really funny photo on this, but we've got this back this time, sorry.
Okay. I don't mind, but if you went somewhere else, you could like switch the sound on, you see, and you might find it a better experience. For many things, discrete probability distributions are the right way to model what you're dealing with. But actually, aside from the scale of the very, very small that you think about when you're doing quantum physics, you can model the world usually much better using continuous variables and real numbers and calculus and continuous probability distributions. And that's what I'd like to start to talk about. So this is kind of revision, and I'm never, it's because of the kind of the one bit that misaligns is what I'm doing here and what's going on in Maths4Inf. So have you done all this stuff on continuous probability distributions very recently? So you know all about probability density functions? Cool, then we can go quickly. So let me tell you, so, no, seriously, but you've all been doing this. You know about cumulative, right? You know, and let's go to this point. Right. You know that a probability, if you go and take the cumulative distribution and you go and take its derivative, then you get the probability density function. This is, you're all familiar with this. So I have this really hokey example of waiting for a bus, and you know your bus comes every 30 minutes with extreme regularity. So the cumulative looks like this, going at zero up to 30 minutes when it hits one, and then it goes flat. And then we take the, so that's your cumulative, and the probability density function is you go and get this constant value between 0 and 30, otherwise it's 0. So that's our cumulative, and that's the PDF. And we can do useful things. So we can write the cumulative as the integral of the probability density function. So the cumulative at point B is just the integral from minus infinity to B, and the cumulative at point A is the integral from minus infinity to A of the probability density function. So if you want to look at the probability that A falls between A and B, where A is less than B, then you simply take the difference of these two integrals, which just gives you the definite integral between A and B of the probability density function of X. So this gives you a way to kind of visualize what goes on with a PDF. So if you want to know the probability that something lies between minus 2 and plus 2 for this particular probability density function, then we're just looking at the integral between minus 2 and plus 2, the bit in red. So a couple of things to bear in mind about probability density functions. And it's worth being reminded of this. So under probability, when you've got a probability density function, it's the area under the curve that integrates to 1, which means that the actual value of the probability density function can go above 1. You can have very spiky probability density functions. So that's worth bearing in mind. They're not probabilities, they're probability densities. Okay. Have you just had a lecture about the Gaussian distribution? Good. I shall go more slowly through this because we are going to concentrate on doing stuff with Gaussians. And I think pretty quickly we're going to deviate in what we do with Gaussian from what you get in maths for inf. So the Gaussian really is the most common and it's the most easily analyzed continuous distribution. And there are many situations where it's a reasonable model. There are also many situations where it's not such a reasonable model, and we can talk about that. If a scalar variable has a Gaussian distribution, then it has then you get the functional form that looks like this. And have I got a picture good? Yeah, but I don't have the. Stay here. I did my slide wrong. I should have had the curve with the equation. Let's talk about this equation because it's important to understand what's going on with the Gaussian distribution. And I don't know. Some people sometimes think it's a bit of a mystery. I mean, it's a very straightforward expression if you understand what's going on with each part. So. Gaussian is defined by two parameters, the mean, and which would give the symbol mu, and the variance, which would give the symbol sigma squared. Think of the mu as a location parameter. It tells you where the Gaussian is centered. And think of the sigma squared as a dispersion parameter. It tells you how wide and how high a Gaussian is. Since it's a probability density function, the width and the height will go together. So if you've got a Gaussian that's higher, it's going to be narrower. If you've got a Gaussian that's lower, it's going to be wider. And you can see this in the formula. If we then go and look at how the formula for a Gaussian works. So we look at the bit that's inside the exponential. The top bit, you're basically taking the difference between x, which is the point you're concerned with, the argument to the function, and you're basically looking at the squared distance of x from the mean. So you know that thing, x minus mu squared, is always going to be positive. It's a squared distance. We take a negative sign, so we know the numerator is always going to be zero or negative. So the largest the numerator is going to be is zero. Otherwise, it's going to be minus. As the point gets further and further away from the mean, it's going to get more and more negative. The denominator is 2 times the variance, or 2 times the standard deviation squared. So what you know about this is that the denominator is always going to be positive. The variance is always greater than zero, so the denominator will always be positive. So the whole thing is always going to be zero or negative. So if you take the exponential of that, well, the biggest it's going to be is when you're taking the exponential of zero, which works out to be 1. Otherwise, it's going to be smaller. So the reason that we can think of the mean as a location parameter is that the Gaussian is going to have its peak, its mode, when the point x is on top of the mean. You've got a distance of zero there, so that's like the centre of the Gaussian. It's the maximum of the Gaussian. You can think of it as the point in space. You can think of the Gaussian as basically taking a point in space and sort of fuzzifying it around. And the further you go, the smaller it gets. That's basically what's going on with the Gaussian, and that's what's happening here. And that's why we think of the mean as a location parameter. And then the variance is the dispersion. So it's telling you how fast the Gaussian goes down, how fast this thing gets, how fast it gets to zero, or put it in the way, how fast the exponential gets to zero. So think of the whole thing. So when you have a very small variance, then you're going to get something where you'll get a behavior where it looks, where your Gaussian is going to look something like that, and whereas a larger variance is, it's going to look more like that. So the variance is kind of giving you the width of a Gaussian. Since we're going to very soon be thinking in more than one dimension, it's better to think of it as a dispersion rather than a width, because a width is a rather kind of one-dimensional thing to think about. And very soon we're going to be thinking about many dimensions, because we're working in the world of using these things to model feature vectors. Now, I've gone a bit too far. I've done more than I should have said, because actually, at the moment, we're just getting the width, and there's no change in height, right? If you don't look at the normalization term, if you don't look at the normalization term at the front, then it's basically you've got one will look like that, and one would look like that, essentially. And that's not good, because you want things to integrate to one. So we need this normalization term. Basically, it's controlling the height, so that when a Gaussian is wider, it becomes lower. And the form of this normalization term comes about because it's what you need to make this whole thing to integrate to one between minus infinity and plus infinity. So if we go and look at a Gaussian with zero mean and unit variance, then you get this kind of standard bell shape. How many people even recognize this now? The longer you go, the more of a historical artifact it becomes. So it was very beautiful up until the advent of the euro. If you went to Germany, you'd get a 10-mark note. And you would get a picture of Gauss, and you get a picture of the Gaussian distribution. And this image isn't good enough, but the beautiful thing about the Gaussian distribution that they had in the 10-mark note is that the parameters are marked, the mean is marked, the variance is marked. It's not just some graphic designer drawing something that looks vaguely bell-shaped. It's done right. That was very great. Anyway, fewer and fewer of these in existence, I guess. So let's have a look at the effect of the mean and the variance. So the mean basically is just a location parameter. So if you moved the mean of this from 0 to minus 2, it would be centered there, or to plus 2, it would be centered there. The variance is this dispersion parameter. So you get this quite kind of high but narrow thing for a variance of 1. Then for a variance of 2, you get a lower and slightly wider thing, and then for a variance of 4, you get an even lower and even wider thing. Do practice sketching Gaussians. It's a good thing to be able to do, and it doesn't require artistic skill. It just requires kind of practice. What can we say about the Gaussian? And you'll have surely have done this in your maths course, but just in case you haven't, there's a lot of useful facts about the Gaussian, and it's. If you've got any kind of random variable that tends to cluster around the mean, then a Gaussian is usually not a bad approximation to describe that random variable. So, some facts about a Gaussian: about 68% of values drawn from a Gaussian or a normal distribution are within one standard deviation from the mean. About 95% are within 2 standard deviations, and 99.7% lie within 3 standard deviations, and like 99.9999 lie within like 5 standard deviations of the mean. So the drawback that you can have with a Gaussian is that it doesn't model outliers very well. So unusual values of your random variable. So values which are quite far away from the mean will often end up with lower probability densities. There'll be less probability of a variable being more than 5 standard deviations from the mean than you might observe in real life. So if you're using a Gaussian distribution to kind of estimate probabilities of certain things that occur in real life, then if what you're really interested in are the unusual events which are several standard deviations from the mean, you can get dramatic underestimates. Now, it's not as dramatic an underestimate as giving something a 0 probability that you might get in document classification, but it is a dramatic underestimate all the same. And it turns out that examples of things that aren't modelled well by a Gaussian when you're far, far away from the mean include certain things that come up in kind of economic and financial pricing, and at least part of the reason that there was a credit crunch was due to the fact that there were models based on Gaussians and were dramatically underestimating the probability of very rare events. If you like reading about that sort of stuff, there's a book called, let me get the title, it's called The Black Swan by Taleb, and it's a good read, and I highly recommend it to you. It was about 2 or 3 years ago that it came out, predating the credit crunch, by the way, and it's a very good read if you're interested in modelling rare events. It can be classed as popular science rather than highly technical, for sure, but I recommend it. The other thing that comes up about the that comes up with Gaussians, and actually let me say sort of one more thing. So still quite common, I think. I mean, you can call it the normal distribution or the Gaussian distribution. And I've never particularly liked the phrase normal distribution, and certainly in the sort of world of sort of engineering that I really do, which is sort of signal processing and things like that, people have for a long time preferred the term Gaussian to normal. And one of the reasons is that it was always very, very clear that although it's commonly observed behavior that things behave in a Gaussian way, you shouldn't think of it as normal behavior, because there are some things which are just naturally non-Gaussian. And the calling it the normal distribution is kind of a little misnomer. So you can call it a normal distribution if you want, but I think from now on, in these lectures, I'll just refer to it as a Gaussian distribution. Yeah, the central limit theorem again. I don't know if you do this at all in second year maths. You Does he do this in any detail, or she, or no? So it's worth knowing about. I'm not going to do it in any detail at all, but it's worth knowing of its existence, and it's in part of the reason that Gaussians are so important. So the central limit theorem tells you that under certain reasonably mild conditions, actually, the sum of a large number of random variables will have something close to the normal distribution. And it turns out there's a lot of other important distributions that in certain circumstances can be very well modeled by a normal Gaussian distribution. So for example, if you take a binomial, when you've got a very large value of n, and your probability of p isn't too extreme, so it's not nearly 1 or nearly 0, that could be very well modeled by Gaussian. Again, values of the Poisson distribution, when the parameter is large, can be well modeled by Gaussian. And there's many other distributions, which you may or may not have come across, that also get well modeled by Gaussian. And for some things, Wikipedia, I think, has decidedly dodgy entries. I haven't actually checked this year, but last year, the Wikipedia entry on the Gaussian distribution I thought was really good. And that picture, I think, came from the Wikipedia entry. So it's worth looking at. But we want to use Gaussians as models of the real world. And that means we want to estimate the parameters from data that we observe. So it's for a single univariate, well, even for a multivariate Gaussian, it's really quite straightforward to do a maximum likelihood estimate of the parameters of a Gaussian. So again, a maximum likelihood estimate is we're thinking of our Gaussian as a generative model. So what we mean by using a Gaussian for a generative model is that you have your Gaussian distribution, then your generative model for your parameter, and you're not dealing with sequences at all, you want to know what the value of x1 is, you just basically pick a random number, but it's weighted by the Gaussian with the mean and the variance that you have. You want to know what x2 is, pick a random number, and then weight it by the Gaussian with that mean and variance. So that's your kind of generative model of things, and then if you get a bunch of data, you can estimate the likelihood that it was generated by a particular Gaussian. So you can do pattern recognition in this way. You can, you might be doing image recognition or something like that. You can, if you want, represent each class by a Gaussian. It may have to be a multidimensional Gaussian, but we'll come to that, which represents each class. And then we can use that Gaussian as a generative model. So once we've trained it, if you get a new data point, you get a new image, for example, you can use your Gaussian to give an estimate of the probability that it was generated by the Gaussian representing class 1 or by the Gaussian representing class 2. And then we can use the same framework as before for our statistical pattern recognition. So that's good. And one of the nice things about training, estimating the parameters of Gaussian is that the maximum likelihood estimates are really very straightforward and are really very intuitive. So if you've got n data points, then the maximum likelihood estimate of a mean of a Gaussian for that class, if you've got n data points in the same class, the maximum likelihood estimate for the mean is just the sample mean. And the maximum likelihood estimate for the variance is just the sample variance. In this case, it's important to realize that the maximum likelihood estimates for the variance are the type normalized by 1 over n. So as was discussed a little bit in one of the tutorials, this is what's called a biased estimate. But we know maximum likelihood estimates aren't perfect. But let's just stick with maximum likelihood estimates for the time being. And the maximum likelihood estimate for the variance of a Gaussian is just the sample variance of the points that you observe in that class. And of course, the difference between this estimate of the variance and the one normalized by 1 over n minus 1 is really very small once you have a large number of parameters, n is a large number of data points, n is large. So if we just look at this really simple example, we've got a pattern recognition with two classes, S and T, and we've got some observations available for each class. And we would now like to train our models. We want to train a Gaussian for each class. So that means estimating the parameters of the Gaussian PDF for each class. So quick exercise in mental arithmetic, although it's probably in the notes. What's the mean value of the Gaussian for class S? Ten. You can shout out. You don't have to whisper. It's not private. And the variance? It's an easy one, really. Variance?
One.
Yes. 0 + 4 + 0 + 0 + 1 + 1 / 6. And for the second one, what's the mean?
12.
I'll take your word for it. Yes, it looks like 12. And the variance? Spot on. Again, we're just looking there.
That's 0 + 0 + 9 + 9 + 4 + 1 + 1.
Cheers. Okay, 24/6. I should have said. So, should we? Oh yeah, let's. You know, so those are your distributions. We can sketch the PDF for each class. We'll come to this later. But already looking at the PDF for each class, having sketched these things, let's just assume that when we come to do pattern recognition using these things, you might include prior probabilities. But if you don't include prior probabilities, you can start to just look at what the probability density functions are doing. If you look at these two probability density functions, you can see that between about whatever that number is, probably about 11 or something, and so when it's greater than 11, the red curve is always bigger than the blue curve. No, because the red curve has a greater dispersion than the blue class, then the red one is always going to be above the blue one off to infinity. And then likewise, from about 11 to about whatever number that is, 7 or something, then the blue curve is always above the red. But at that point, they cross again, and the red curve is always going to be bigger off to minus infinity. So just looking at the PDFs, the blue curve is greater than the red curve just for this zone between 7 and 12 or something, and 11, and these are basically your decision boundaries. We're going to do this in a lot more detail, and we're going to look at the beautiful relationship between Gaussians and their parameters and the equations of decision boundaries, but that's for the future. Yeah, I'm going to stop there. We can move on to multivariate Gaussians next week.